And now it's time for the Earth First Update, brought to you every week right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 and www.freakradio.org. The Earth First Update is environmental news about action and activists. And I suggest that you have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write down something that you might hear, because you might want to take part in some of this. For instance, the Alameda Creek cleanup is coming up this coming Monday, January 20th, in Fremont, California. Monday, January 20th is Martin Luther King's Day of Service, and the Alameda Creek Alliance is sponsoring a creek cleanup alongside Alameda Creek in Fremont, California. Join us at our newly adopted stretch of Alameda Creek at the bottom of Niles Canyon, just upstream from the Niles staging area. We will meet at 10 a.m. and work until about 12:30. We'll clean trash from the creek and remove ivy invading some of the large mature trees at the site. Our work will vary from easy to straining based on individual interests and abilities. We'll provide gloves, tools, water, and snacks. You should wear long pants, a long-sleeve shirt, and shoes with good traction, as the ground can be uneven. Meet at the parking lot for the Niles staging area of the Alameda Creek Trail near Mission Boulevard and Niles Road off Old Canyon Road in Fremont. If you arrive late, follow the path upstream past the picnic area to find us. If you'd like to, please RSVP to Ralph at alamedacreek.org. That's Ralph, R-A-L-P-H, at alamedacreek.org. And if you need any more information, go to their webpage, www.alamedacreek.org. And have fun out there at that cleanup Monday, January 20th, 10 a.m. at the Niles staging area. And Sea Shepherd has Japan's whaling fleet on the run in this story by Jethro Mullen of CNN and found on the Earth First Newswire, also on the Sea Shepherd Australia webpage. Environmental activists have declared an early success at the start of their annual high seas showdown with Japanese whalers in Antarctic waters. The anti-whaling group Sea Shepherd Australia said its ships had split up the Japanese fleet in the Southern Ocean and chased it out of the main Antarctic zone. The whale poaching fleet is scattered and currently not hunting whales, Sea Shepherd said in a statement. But Japanese authorities say the hunt is still on. Japan's fleet carries out annual whale hunt despite a worldwide moratorium, taking advantage of a loophole in the law that permits the killing of mammals for scientific research. Whale meat is commonly available for consumption in Japan. Each year, environmental groups like Sea Shepherd pursue the Japanese hunters in an attempt to disrupt the whaling. The resulting confrontations have led to collisions of ships and the detention of activists. Sea Shepherd said last Monday, a week from this last Monday, that Japanese fleet's harpoon ships are separated by hundreds of miles. The factory ship, the Nishin Maru, is on the run, the environmental group claimed. It said its three ships had ushered the Japanese fleet out of the Antarctic Treaty Zone, the internationally designated area below 60 degrees south latitude. Within a day and a half, we have the entire whaling fleet in disarray, said Siddharth Chakravarti, the captain of one of the Sea Shepherd ships. Japan's fisheries agency, which oversees the annual hunt, said Tuesday that the whaling operation has not been halted. It said the fleet remains in the Southern Ocean, which is generally considered to cover a similar area to the Antarctic Treaty Zone. The agency declined, however, to comment specifically on Sea Shepherd's claims or on the fleet's exact whereabouts. Last Monday, Sea Shepherd published photos and videos that it said showed three harpooned minke whales lying on the deck of the Nishin Maru and another being butchered. The Australian government has challenged the Japanese whaling program in the International Court of Justice, but the current hunt will continue, and the Sea Shepherd activists say they'll continue the fight. We have won this battle, said Adam Meyerson, another of the group's ship captains, but the war for the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary will wage on over the coming months. Sea Shepherd has all ships in the Japanese whaling fleet accounted for and confirmed that the whale poaching fleet is scattered and currently not hunting whales. The harpoon ships are separated by hundreds of miles. The Nisshin Maru is on the run and unable to stop and whale in its self-designated whale poaching grounds. The Japanese whaling fleet was escorted across 60 degrees south and past the northern limit of the Antarctic Treaty Zone by the Sea Shepherd ships, the Sam Simon, the Steve Irwin, and the Steve Irwin's helicopter. Three Sea Shepherd ships are still in the Southern Ocean and will continue patrols. Should the Nisshin Maru attempt to return to the whaling ground, Sea Shepherd will be ready once again to intercept and shut down their illegal whaling operations. And in other Australian news, Fearless Summer Australia blocks exports of timber products in this story from the Earth First Newswire. According to press releases and Facebook updates from Fearless Summer Australia, a group of conservationists gathered at the Hobart port on January 8th, where a ship was loading native forest veneer for export overseas. Holding a banner calling for an end to native forest destruction, the group stands in solidarity with conservationists in New South Wales and Victoria, who simultaneously halted the loading of a wood chip ship in Eden, Australia. From the veneer ships in Tasmania to the wood chip ships exporting the forests of New South Wales and Victoria, conservationists are today taking a stand against the chain of forest destruction, said Miranda Gibson, spokesperson for Still Wild, Still Threatened. In Eden, New South Wales, two people were arrested after locking themselves to the wood chip conveyor in order to stop the loading of the wood chip vessel. This action is part of Fearless Summer, a national collaboration between grassroots forest groups from around Australia. After a nine-hour shutdown of ship loading at Eden Woodchip Mill, our courageous lock-ons were cut free and taken away to be charged. The officer who cut them off did so in a reckless way, and they were injured in the process. Thankfully, not life-threatening. A formal complaint will be lodged. The destruction of our forests is a national shame to add insult to injury. Our biodiverse native forests are being destroyed at a loss to Australian taxpayers while being shipped offshore by international companies like Ta'an and Nippon Paper, said Ms. Gibson. Every day our precious forests are being lost and our wildlife pushed closer to extinction while the taxpayer foots the bill. The forest industry has proven itself time and again to have blatant disregard for the environment and its own regulations. What we are seeing is an extinction crisis in the making, happening across Australia, and the fearless action of these conservationists to confront this shows great courage, said David Caldwell of the Goonera Environment Center. The two conservationists have been charged with remaining on enclosed lands, probably similar to trespassing, and with intimidation. These are the same charges that two other conservationists faced for locking down on a conveyor back in December. Those conservationists appeared in Eden Court and pled guilty to the enclosed lands charge, but not guilty to the charge of intimidation. Their brief will be handed down on the 12th of February and their case heard on the 5th of March. After the Northern Gateway recommendation, Unist Camp ups the ante against the oil pipeline in this story by Aaron Flegg of the Vancouver Observer as found on the Earth First Newswire. With the announcement of the National Energy Boards of Canada's ruling in favor of Enbridge's Northern Pipeline, and the fall of yet another government environmental safeguard, the organizers of the anti-pipeline blockade camp in northern British Columbia are more committed than ever to holding their ground. Along with partner Forest Action Network, they've put out a call for more volunteers, and fan director Zoe Blunt says they've received a flood of applications in the past week from people eager to travel to the camp and help out. Blunt, who has been to the camp several times, said she has been involved in the fighting tankers on the coast when she realized she needed to start higher up the chain. If there are no pipelines, she said, there can be no tankers. We found kind of a choke point here in the Morris River Valley, and if we can slow it down, close it off, stall it, it's buying time for another kind of outcome. That could mean decisions made by the courts or by the commodities markets. If the economy contracts again, these pipelines are a lot less likely to go through. The Unist At'en clan of the Wet'suwet'en people have put themselves in the path of multiple pipelines, including the already approved Pacific Trails liquefied natural gas pipeline and the Enbridge Northern Gateway bitumen pipeline. By the way, the Enbridge Northern Gateway bitumen pipeline is related to the Keystone XL pipeline that ships bitumen south. Only the Enbridge Northern Gateway would ship bitumen west. Surveyors and oil and gas company employees who have been found in the territory have been escorted out of Unist At'en lands. The camp has existed for the past 4 years, first as a soft blockade, keeping people out of the territory, and has steadily grown to include permanent buildings and permaculture gardens. Volunteers are currently working to build pit houses on the site and collect supplies for the rest of the winter. The camp garnered some media attention in October when an unidentified intruder sent off a homemade bomb at the entrance to the territory. No one was injured and damage was minimal. Camp organizer and member of the Unist At'en, Feda Husson, has just returned to her village after a year of living at the camp. Apart from the incident with the explosive, Husson says the camp has received minimal attention outside independent and social media, and even making use of some of those outlets have proved challenging. She said her posts to Facebook concerning pipelines and the camp's opposition to them are often removed, and she finds herself kicked off of the platform before items can be posted at all. But regardless of the response, she said the Unist At'en have no intention of leaving, even if the oil industry trucks start rolling in. For myself, I believe it's the only way you can get anybody to see your viewpoint. You have to blockade and you have to make your views known through the methods you're using. The Unist At'en say they have never been consulted about the projects expected to run through their territory, and Husson said they've tried talking to those in power but have been let down. Enbridge spokesperson Ivan Geisbrecht said via email that the company has actively engaged with First Nations and Métis groups to incorporate feedback into the project design, and Enbridge is still hopeful that it can address First Nations concerns in a mutual spirit of cooperation and collaboration. He said the company is aware of the blockade but refused to comment further. Many of the volunteers who have traveled to the camp are recent university graduates who have become disillusioned with their jobs and want to find better ways to protect the environment. They're also hoping to boost local support. Most of our support is in the lower mainland, Husson said. Locally, people are all opposing the pipelines, but nobody is stepping up to help. Even financially, most of our support is from the cities. The camp needs people who can help with construction, hauling firewood, and keeping a lookout for intruders on the territory. Husson said they'll need more resources and more support on the land if they're going to succeed in keeping the oil and gas companies out. A sense of the outcome of the joint review panel hearings has caused some worry. It's getting prepared and having enough resources available because we know we're going to be up against industry trying to push their way through. We need more people up there. And Australian activists have blockaded the Laird Forest and protested coal. In this story by Georgina Woods of No Fibs and found on the Earth First Newswire. The battle erupting this week over Maules Creek Coal Project and the Laird State Forest is the focal point for major conflicts and questions facing Australia as the age of coal comes to an end and the age of climate change comes upon us. Maules Creek is a new, large, open-cut coal mine project approved but not yet built in northwest New South Wales. The proponent is Australia's biggest coal local miner, Whitehaven Coal, for whom Maules Creek is a make-or-break project. For over 3 years, local farmers and environmentalists have campaigned against the project. It is expected to create significant dust problems for the nearby Maules Creek community to draw down local groundwater, and thousands of hectares of remnant woodland is slated for clear-cutting. Much of this forest is listed as critically endangered under the Federal Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act of 1999 and harbors a rich diversity of endangered and threatened wildlife, including many birds and bats and the iconic koala bear. The Maules Creek project should have been rejected by the New South Wales and Australian governments on the basis of its environmental impacts alone, But Australian governments are notoriously loath to ever say no to coal mining projects. Increasingly, the project is the focal point for a much bigger quandary for Australia, the role of our coal export industry in driving up global greenhouse gas emissions. There are signs internationally that the age of coal is coming to an end. Production and consumption of thermal coal by the world's biggest producers is falling. China's production is down 3.7%, and the U.S. production was down 4% in the first 6 months of 2013. Coal use by China's electricity sector dropped in 2012, and total U.S. coal consumption has also dropped. Demand in Japan has plateaued, and in South Korea and Taiwan has decreased. Whether or not this change will accelerate quickly enough to avert the worst excesses of global warming and climate change is unclear. What we know is that the world is currently headed decisively for 4 degrees of Celsius warming. That level of warming means an end to the Great Barrier Reef and catastrophic interruption to weather, ecology, agriculture, and ocean systems worldwide. Coal burning is globally the biggest single driver of increased greenhouse pollution, and Australia is the world's second biggest exporter of it. Last year, 30 million tons of coal Australia exported was responsible for 720 million tons of carbon dioxide pollution. Our emissions at home were less than 600 million tons. When Australian politicians and business people talk about the need for other communities to be part of global action to reduce greenhouse emissions before Australia does, they're talking about countries that buy and burn the coal we mine and sell from the Hunter Valley and the Bowen Basin. To have a 50-50 chance of preventing global warming going above 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has previously estimated that global greenhouse gas emissions must peak by 2015. That's next year, folks. With so much at stake, and in the face of craven failure of the Australian political system to grapple with our biggest contribution to climate change, the conflict can only escalate over Maules Creek Mine. It's the largest new coal mine currently under construction in Australia, and the campaign against it has brought together environmentalists with local farmers, traditional owners, and climate change activists. In the last couple of years, protest action at Laird State Forest has been ramping up, with dozens of protests drawing a growing number of people to the forest. In December of 2013, 120 people took part in a large protest against the project, including 74-year-old Raymond McLaren from Tamworth. This week, 5 people so far have been arrested blockading to stop the forest from being cleared, and the battle is intensifying. In the immediate future, there are 2 decisions and opportunities pending that could provide a reprieve for the Laird State Forest. Gomeroi traditional owners have submitted requests for interim and permanent protection orders for their cultural heritage sites, including burial sites. They are bitterly upset with their treatment by Whitehaven and are looking toward Federal Minister of Environment Greg Hunt to agree to stop work orders so that they can care for their sites. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. In capital letters, volunteers needed. Intense field season expected in wild bison country. Government agencies are planning to capture and kill possibly hundreds of wild bison this season. For the first time since 2008, the Montana Department of Livestock intends to put up the Horse Butte bison trap in mid-February. Near Gardner, Yellowstone National Park is poised to capture wild buffalo from inside the park and hand them over to tribal officials for direct shipment to tribal slaughter facilities. Yellowstone may also hand over captured wild buffalo to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service for experimental use in a controversial birth control project. Hunting activities have already taken the lives of 79 buffalo, and these numbers will likely increase as hunting will continue through mid-spring. After all of these malicious actions against wild bison, industrial-strength hazing operations will take place during the thrust of calving season. Buffalo Field Campaign invites you to join us on the front lines here on the edge of the world's first national park to help defend America's last wild buffalo. If you can spare a couple of weeks a month or stay with us for the rest of the season, we welcome your participation. The Buffalo Field Campaign provides room, board, gear, and training, while the Wildlife and Wildlands will provide incredible inspiration. Please visit our volunteer page to fill out an application, email our volunteer coordinators, or call 406-646-0070. And I'll repeat that number a little later. Bring your passion and your ideas. See you on the front lines. Buffalo Field Campaign patrols in Gardner saved the life of a bull buffalo on Tuesday when a 15-year-old boy came out to shoot one of the few shaggy giants moving in and out of Montana. With the help of accompanying adults, the youth found three bulls about 20 feet off from the Old Yellowstone Trail, a north-south gravel road that follows the Yellowstone River through the Gardner Basin. This public road winds through northern portions of Yellowstone National Park, Gallatin National Forest, and the Church Universal and Triumphant Land. Buffalo Field Campaign patrols noticed that the hunter had his rifle resting on the truck, aiming at one of the bulls. In Montana, it is illegal to shoot from your vehicle, across a road, or within 150 feet of a road, and it is every hunter's responsibility to know this. Buffalo Field Campaign patrols informed the hunter of this in time to prevent his shot. The hunt party then attempted to chase the bulls to where he could be shot. They succeeded in chasing him onto private land where no hunting is allowed, and he lived to see another day. The party returned the following day and again attempted to chase the bulls into an area where they could shoot one. The bulls took off, running across the Corwin Springs Bridge toward the Corwin Springs facility, where bison are being held captive by APHIS for their controversial birth control project. Ironically, the familiar Montana Department of Livestock truck arrived, likely to haze the bulls away from their imprisoned relatives. The bulls saw the Montana Department of Livestock truck and wasted no time in heading into Yellowstone National Park, where they are safe from hunters and the Montana Department of Livestock, but not the National Park Service. With word out that a handful of buffalo have been emerging into the Gardner Basin in and out of huntable areas, hunters are beginning to swarm in. But as of this writing, there are no wild buffalo in Montana that hunters can't kill. We are so grateful to our patrols for being there, determining that an illegal kill was about to be made and taking action to save the life of this bull and likely his two companions, not to mention the fact that the kid could have gotten a pretty stiff ticket for that shot. This incident demonstrates how critical it is for us to be in the field with the buffalo. Had the Buffalo Field Campaign not been there, the young boy would certainly have made the shot. Thank you all for making it possible for us to be on the front lines with the buffalo. Because of you, we were able to save a buffalo's life. And if you'd like to send a donation to the Buffalo Field Campaign, please go to their webpage at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, and they have extensive information on what they need. You can also give them a call at 406-646-0070. If you're intending to become a volunteer, please do read their volunteer page. It has lots of good information, and do give them a call before you go. If you do want to make a donation, send it to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. And do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And U.S. wildlife managers urge the lifting of Yellowstone grizzly protections. This story reported by Laura Zuckerman, editing by Steve Gorman and Philip Barbera. World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Federal and state wildlife managers of grizzly bears in the Yellowstone National Park area recommended that the U.S. Endangered Species Act protections be lifted for the animals, a decision that would open the way for them to be hunted. Yellowstone's grizzlies, now classified as a threatened species, were briefly removed from protected status by the federal government in 2007 when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service declared that the outsized hump-shouldered bears had made a healthy comeback. At the time, the number of grizzlies in the region had exceeded the government's recovery goal of 500 bears, the government said. But conservationists successfully challenged the delisting in court, arguing that the government discounted climactic change that brought about the decline of white bark pines, a crucial food source for grizzlies in the Yellowstone area. On Wednesday, members of the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee sought to reverse that decision, recommending a new delisting after reviewing a report suggesting Yellowstone bears can be sustained by berries and a number of other food sources. The panel estimated the grizzly population in and around Yellowstone, which spans parts of Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana, has now climbed to about 600 bears. The recommendation is a formality and not required by law before the Fish and Wildlife Service officially decides whether to propose lifting federal safeguards for Yellowstone area grizzlies, committee spokesman Greg Lusinski said. But environmentalists criticized the recommendation, saying, which they see as a precursor to delisting and ultimately to the sport hunting of grizzly bears. Quote, the grizzly bear is arguably the most beautiful and powerful symbol of our wild heritage. It is vital they make a full recovery so they don't slide back towards extinction, said Bonnie Rice, an official with the Sierra Club chapter in Montana. Dan Ash, now head of the Fish and Wildlife Service, told Reuters in a 2010 interview that the Obama administration would seek to lift Endangered Species Act protections from both wolves and grizzlies in the Yellowstone area. Wolves were delisted in Idaho and Montana in 2011 and Wyoming in 2012. And we have time for another quick story here. Whale zone ahead. Ship speed limits finalized for endangered whales. In a whale-sized win for one of the world's most endangered ocean animals, the National Marine Fisheries Service has permanently adopted speed limits for big ships in habitat for North Atlantic right whales along the entire east coast. The limits, which require large vessels to slow substantially in right whales' presence, were set to expire recently, but the Center and Allies petitioned the Fisheries Service last year to cement them in place. That petition also sought to expand the speed limit zones into additional areas where the whales feed. The Fisheries Service acknowledged that this was needed. Though the North Atlantic right whales grow to a massive 55 feet long, their population is tiny at fewer than 400, decimated in past centuries by commercial whaling. And that's all the time we have for news this week on the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is presented every week here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio. And we thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update, please do so tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you live in the Moscow, Idaho area, you can listen to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, on Monday nights at 9:30 p.m. on 90.3 FM, their new high-power frequency. Or you could go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net. And there you can download or listen to a podcast of the Earth First Update. All right. Thank you for listening, and tune in again next week.